This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, President Clinton proposes to protect 40 million acres of national forest as roadless areas. It's a big policy shift for the Forest Service. The World Trade Organization meets in Seattle in November. Some will be protesting, but the United States wants to use free trade to protect ocean fish. Elimination of DDT to save the environment is difficult in poor countries that are fighting malaria. And on the Earth calendar, coral are spawning on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. The full moon actually turns them on. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Recently on the program, we've addressed a number of issues relating to the health of forest ecosystems, such as the effects of chip mills and Home Depot's decision to phase out wood from endangered forests. Road building in national forests has been a major source of controversy for years. Your tax dollars pay for the construction of the roads that timber companies use to cut lumber. The government gets paid for the wood, but frequently it gets less than the cost of the roads. The roads affect the forests because they fragment habitat and contribute to erosion and siltation, which damages rivers and streams. Now, President Clinton has announced a major new plan that would protect millions of acres from the destruction of logging roads and other activities. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
President Clinton has directed the U.S. Forest Service to begin developing plans to protect the last remaining roadless areas in the national forest system. If this happens, some 40 million acres across the country could be saved from development. Jim Furnish is Deputy Chief for National Forest Systems with the U.S. Forest Service.
I think the states where the bulk of that acreage would be found would be states like Montana, Utah, Idaho, certainly extensive lands in Colorado, California. These would number in the millions of acres in each of those states. And then certainly other states like Oregon, New Mexico, Arizona have some roadless areas as well. But the bulk of these are found in the western United States. The largest quantities are found in Montana, Utah, Idaho.
The protections would apply to isolated forest areas that are 5,000 acres or larger and possibly some smaller tracts. The Forest Service will be looking at environmental impact statements and the planning processes in each forest. In addition, citizens will have opportunities to voice their concerns during meetings to be held around the country. Michael Francis, director of the National Forest Program for the Wilderness Society, says there are two major areas the service and others will be considering.
One is the extent of coverage of this roadless policy. Should it cover all the national forests in the system, including the Tongass National Forest, which is one of the items the administration singled out for discussion? Should it cover the largest national forest and every other national forest in every region, with no exception? Two, should it cover just road building? Should it just be talking about no more new roads in there? Or should it address no logging in those areas, no illegal intrusions by ORV and ATV use, no oil and gas exploration, and withdrawing these lands from the Mineral Leasing Act of 1872.
Francis calls the president's move an historical event, and other environmentalists say Clinton's plan could give him a permanent environmental legacy. But not everyone is happy with the plan. The timber industry opposes it, saying 80% of national forests are already off-limits to its members. Right now, about 5% of the nation's timber comes from national forests, and experts say a small percentage of that, about 5%, comes from roadless areas. Michael Klein, spokesman for the American Forest and Paper Association, which represents some timber companies, believes the lack of logging in national forests threatens their health and residents near them. He blames President Clinton and the Forest Service.
They're currently neglecting the national forests, and they've got 66 million acres of what the Forest Service estimates is high risk for catastrophic wildfire and insect and disease infestation. There's no plan to treat those acres. We're talking about an area the size of Georgia and Ohio combined, and it's going to burn up, it's going to die, it's just going to be gone. It's negligent, and unfortunately, problems that start, a wildfire that starts on public land, can easily spread to private land.
Also, timber officials and some Republicans have questioned whether the president has the authority to direct such a move. But Michael Francis with the Wilderness Society says most of the complaints are coming from Republican members of Congress from Western states whose philosophies of exploitation, he believes, are 19th century. Meanwhile, a lot of newspapers and other representatives are supporting the president's plan to protect some of the most pristine forest areas in the country. Today, there are about 191 million acres in the U.S. national forest system. So protecting 40 million acres from development is a significant step now and for the future health of these ecosystems, especially since there are already some 380,000 miles of roads in the system. While the scope of President Clinton's announcement is impressive, it wasn't all that surprising. For months, the administration, including Forest Service Chief Michael Dombeck, has been moving away from the environmentally destructive practice of road building. Again, Michael Francis with the Wilderness Society.
It comes out of Chief Dombeck's 18-month moratorium on road building that it was issued last February, and that is a result of actions that the chief started a year before then about reviewing how, when, and where, and why the Forest Service builds roads.
Forest Service officials say the agency has been trying to protect areas in the Northwest, the Columbia Basin, Southern Appalachia, and other areas, and Deputy Chief Jim Furnish adds the service itself is slowly changing its philosophy.
All of these have pointed with pretty compelling scientific evidence that a lot of these roadless areas are some of the most pristine lands we have in terms of providing for biological diversity, endangered species habitats, strongholds for fish stocks, clean water, clean air, incredible scenery. So I think what we're seeing come into play are a whole new palette of values that, frankly, were not considered very strongly 15 or 20 years ago. And I think it's that issue that is really driving the agency to take a hard look so that we can really make a good determination for the future about how these lands ought to be managed in the public interest.
Public comments could play a huge role in the president's plan to protect the 40 million acres, and all sides are encouraging citizens to do so. Following environmental reviews and public input, the Forest Service is expected to issue its decision late next year, just before President Clinton leaves office. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
On November 30, the World Trade Organization, known as the WTO, will be meeting in Seattle. It's reported that a number of environmental organizations and some labor groups from the United States and Canada are planning massive demonstrations. The WTO was formed as a replacement for GATT, which is the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade. Critics say the WTO nullifies environmental laws of member states by finding them to be barriers to trade.
The WTO, in 5 years of operation, has so systematically wiped out literally every single environmental health or safety law that's been brought for review before its tribunals, and as well, threats of WTO action have caused countries to drop important health, public safety, environmental laws, that an enormous number of non-governmental organizations from all over the world are outraged by this organization. All of their life's work to pass an important environmental treaty or to pass an important domestic law on the environment has been clobbered by the secretive, powerful body that many of them didn't even know came into existence.
That was Lori Wallach, director of Global Trade Watch, a program of Public Citizen, which is an advocacy group formed by Ralph Nader. Lawyer Stephen Cass, who heads the environmental practice group of the New York City law firm Carter, Ledyard & Milbourne, and who writes frequently on matters of international environmental law, has a different view. He says WTO's approach toward environmental protection has evolved.
The WTO, which was established to administer world trade under the Uruguay-Round trade agreements, does have as its principal purpose the elimination of trade barriers and tariffs. And in some context, does call into question environmental restrictions which can be characterized as trade barriers. On the other hand, Article 20 of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade does specifically authorize a broad range of environmental restrictions, provided they are not used as disguised tariff barriers. I think the WTO has been working with some success in the last year to overcome the charge that its primary purpose was trade at the expense of the environment. And I think it now recognizes that environmental restrictions must be enforced and respected.
Some of the controversy arose from rulings against the United States by the WTO and its predecessor. The U.S. was held to violate free trade when it stopped the import of tuna and shrimp that were caught in ways that endangered dolphin and sea turtles caught in the same nets. In both cases, the enforcement of U.S. wildlife protection laws was held to violate trade rules. Cass says that in these cases, the validity of U.S. protection was recognized. The problem was procedures used by the United States, and they can be corrected.
The WTO appellate body clearly recognized that the U.S. efforts to protect sea turtles were legitimate and were non-discriminatory. The only complaint was that it had gone about it without talking with anyone else, and it had imposed a very short period of time, just 4 months, for most nations of the world to refit their vessels, and in fact prohibited the import of shrimp from vessels that used turtle excluder devices if their countries did not have an administrative regime similar to that of the U.S.
While the demonstrators at Seattle will be protesting the existence of the World Trade Organization, the United States Trade Representative, who represents the U.S. and the WTO, has a specific environmental agenda for the conference. Jennifer Haverkamp is the Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Environment and Natural Resources.
We are trying to ensure that the negotiations that are launched at the WTO fully incorporate environment and sustainable development into the work of the WTO, and we have several specific objectives that we're pursuing along those lines. We're trying to look for what we call win-win opportunities, where trade liberalization and environmental protection can be accomplished together, such as lowering trade barriers for environmental goods and services. And for a particular note is that we are seeking through the WTO the elimination of fisheries subsidies that contribute to overfishing worldwide.
Haverkamp says another objective is to make the WTO more open to environmental and other groups.
We also have a very strong transparency agenda to try to open up the institution and improve the public understanding and opportunity to interact with the WTO. We feel there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of misimpressions and suspicion about how this institution operates, and one of the best things that can be done is to open it up so people can see what's happening and contribute to that dialogue. We're trying to do this through a variety of means, including making documents more publicly available and more quickly, through opening up the dispute settlement process so that dispute settlement hearings are open to the public, so that interested groups can submit what we call amicus briefs, provide their views to dispute settlement panels, looking for consultative mechanisms where civil society can interact on a more regular basis with the Secretariat and the members of the WTO.
Anticipating conflict at Seattle, Haverkamp says the U.S. Trade Representative welcomes a lively debate over the issues, but the U.S. does not agree with calls to eliminate or completely restructure the World Trade Organization.
We believe that the WTO's current rules provide good protections for governments' environmental health and safety regulations. The tuna dolphin case that you mentioned is under the old GATT, and there's been quite a development in the jurisprudence since then in the couple of cases that have come down that have addressed some of these issues, and particularly in the recent shrimp turtle case, which we were very disappointed to have lost. The appellate body still said that it was not our law itself that was WTO inconsistent. It was that the way we were implementing it was discriminatory against some countries. And so we feel that the WTO does recognize countries' right to regulate based on how, in this case, the issue was how products are made.
That was Jennifer Haverkamp, Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for the Environment and Natural Resources, discussing the United States' agenda for the upcoming meeting of the World Trade Organization, which will be celebrating the fifth anniversary of its founding during the first week of December. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Regular mail is The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Recently, representatives from 110 countries gathered in Geneva, Switzerland to discuss the problem of persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. These are chemicals such as dioxin that are known to cause birth defects, cancer, and nervous system disorders. But the benefits of a particular chemical continues to be debated, one that can save lives while destroying wildlife and affecting human health. From Swiss Radio International, Peter Capella reports.
Persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, are commonly known as the Dirty Dozen. In fact, the range of chemicals is far wider. It includes dioxin, even ingredients commonly used in plastic bags. Once they pollute the environment or they're absorbed by the human body, they linger. A recent scare about dioxin contamination in Belgian chickens also showed how they can be transferred along the food chain. Some types of POPs are outlawed in many countries. And the United Nations Environment Programme wants a worldwide ban within years. But one type of POP, the insecticide DDT, is dominating the debate. It's a cheap insecticide which is valuable in developing countries to eliminate mosquitoes that carry disease, notably malaria. That's produced demands for an exemption and sympathy from the United Nations. But it's opposed by environmental groups including the Worldwide Fund for Nature. Rich Lieroff of the WWF.
Countries say we want to move away from DDT or we want to reserve the right to use DDT if we need it. I mean, it's an understandable escape clause. Now, any treaty dealing with chemicals that address public health will always have a public health exemption, public health emergency kind of exemption, and it's eminently understandable. I think countries need to have the latitude to use DDT if they really, truly need it. The larger question is, do they really, truly need it? The answer in most cases probably is no, but reliance on it occurs for historical reasons, convenience, and the like.
WWF says there are valid and successful alternatives to DDT, ranging from insect-eating fish to another type of insecticide known as synthetic pyrethroid. But the health community is divided. DDT is still used in about 20 countries. Recently, Tanzania, which had avoided using DDT for many years, resorted to the insecticide to control the massive surge in malaria. It could no longer afford anything better. Despite its 6 case studies showing that alternatives do work, even the WWF admits that few want to use DDT.
These cases suggest what we're talking about really is accelerating a move away from DDT that has already occurred. It's not as if there's widespread reliance on DDT and now we're calling for a dramatic move away from DDT. That shift has already occurred. What we really need these negotiations to do simply to accelerate the movement by increasing the financial commitments of the developed world to malaria programs in the developing world.
Only 3 countries, China, India, and Mexico, still produce DDT. The WWF dropped its insistence on a 2007 deadline for its elimination. But rich countries have yet to promise that they'll help poor ones like Tanzania pay for the alternatives. Peter Capella in Geneva.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It's springtime in Australia, the time of year when beautiful coral reproduce along the Great Barrier Reef. The reef is a massive structure, hundreds of miles long. It's mostly made up of dead skeletons of tiny creatures, but a small percentage of the reef is comprised of living organisms. It's estimated that Australia has some 450 species of coral in its coastal waters. Dr. Richard Miller, professor of biology at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, describes some coral that are beginning to reproduce as we broadcast.
The coral which actually is the first one to go is Montipora digitata. There are also a group called the favids, which turned out to be boulder-like corals. The oculinas, which are branched, relatively delicate corals. The mussids, which are also rather heavy, massive corals. The parietids, some of which are relatively small, bushy types, and others which are extremely large, the real boulder corals.
Most corals engage in what is called external fertilization. Reproduction begins following the appearance of the first full moon, when corals produce eggs and sperm that are bundled together. And Dr. Miller says when the time is right, the bundles are released.
And when the spawning event takes place, these so-called egg-sperm bundles look like little spheres, and each polyp opens its mouth and releases these spheres. The spheres are positively buoyant and float up toward the surface. The next few days, the other species of corals, particularly the acroporas, will spawn, and one can get hundreds of thousands to millions of these spherical balls of eggs and sperm floating upward to the surface.
Corals release these bundles at about the same time, which creates sort of a slick at the ocean's surface. Some eggs become fertilized, while others aren't so lucky. Those that have become fertilized sometimes die because they were fertilized by the wrong type of coral sperm. This is known as hybridization, which can cause abnormal fertilization. Again, Dr. Miller.
This is a mass of dead coral larvae, or dead eggs, which mass together and form a kind of fatty material that floats on the surface, embedded in which are live coral larvae. These slicks drift long distances, and presumably they're dropping larvae as they go. And these larvae swim to the bottom, settle down, and form a new colony, if they're lucky. And eventually the slicks break up and disintegrate, and the material becomes nutrients for other organisms on the reef.
Dr. Miller adds, by traveling miles at the surface of the ocean, the eggs and sperm allow corals to spread their genes to distant areas, which contributes to genetic diversity. Coral reefs are rich in biodiversity, and some experts refer to them as the tropical rainforests of the seas. But a number of problems are threatening the health of coral reefs in Australia, Southeast Asia, and the Caribbean. Dr. Miller says increased water temperatures are causing coral bleaching. Many corals are being taken for souvenirs, while others are gathered for use in aquarium tanks. The use of cyanide to kill fish is damaging coral, and some 20 new fungal and viral diseases have also been identified in recent years.
And, by the way, there is even another factor here, which is the problem of rising sea levels as a result of global warming. Some people believe that global warming is not going to be a problem, but 99% of the scientists who work in these areas believe that, in fact, it is going to happen. And as a result, sea level will rise potentially quite rapidly, and the one question is whether or not the corals can grow fast enough to catch up. Corals are dependent on sunlight for growth, and of course, if the sunlight is decreased by rise in surface, sea level surface, then the corals may begin to die.
Corals are amazing structures that can appear as if they originated from another world. They're found in a variety of shapes and vibrant hues of blues, greens, yellows, and reds, and other colors. Any creature that builds a hard shell and spawns on a barrier reef in the full moon deserves a better fate than being cooked as the climate changes. Why not a coral delegation at the next Kyoto Climate Change Conference? You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, how can our national parks survive with more and more people visiting them? Do we need more parkland, or should some that we have be sold? We talk green about it. A brutal military dictatorship in Nigeria has been replaced. Is the new civilian government doing a better job protecting the environment, or are the multinational oil companies in charge? Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be discussing national treasures which are loved by all of us and which are under incredible stress, and that is our national parks. We're loving them to death, and constantly increased use is taking its toll. The issue, then, is what should be done to keep them in good health, and my guests bring different perspectives to the issue. I've known them all for years, and I know that there are some things that they probably will not agree on. Joining us from Washington are Paul Pritchard, and he is president of the National Park Trust. That's an organization that's dedicated to preserving and protecting America's parklands. Also with us is Dennis Galvin. He's deputy director of the U.S. National Park Service, which means that he is the number two person in the entire service. Also with us is Jerry Taylor. He's director of natural resource studies with the Cato Institute. That's a public policy organization with libertarian and conservative perspectives. So, Paul Pritchard from the National Park Trust, from your perspective, what kind of shape are the parks in?
I think the parks are in the condition that they have been continually deteriorating because of the lack of funding by the Congress and by the administration. Our major area of focus is also on the lack of acquisition of inholdings and new parks. So we're looking not just at the issues of the existing parks, but also the future legacy to America's next generations.
Now, for listeners who haven't heard the word, inholdings are privately owned portions of land that are inside a park because they were there when the park was formed or put together. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And of the 84 million acres, roughly, that we have in the national park system, 6 million of those acres are privately owned. Not all of them are immediately threatened, but we need to have a plan of action. The Land and Water Conservation Fund was conceived in part to address this, but we just have not been committing ourselves, as past generations did, to providing that legacy. And I think that's the challenge for the future.
Okay, Dennis Galvin from the Park Service. What's your perspective on the kind of shape our parks are in and what needs to be done?
Well, Peter, I divide the answer to that question into two parts. I think one is the part that that Paul alluded to, and that is you've got the pressure of increased visitation on an infrastructure that probably, in the best of circumstances, is over 30 years old. Probably an influence that is somewhat more subtle, but in reality, I think more challenging is the idea that the world around parks, that the boundaries of parks have changed substantially. If you take a place like Yellowstone, what's going on in the surrounding countryside is a lot different now than it was 100 years ago when the park was created, and that has a lot of effect on migratory patterns. It has a lot of effect on air quality in parks. On the cultural side, you have kind of the same thing happening with Civil War parks. You've got commercial development and residential development occurring on the boundaries of Civil War parks where previously there had been agricultural uses.
Are you suggesting to us that that McDonald's next to the battlefield wasn't there when the Confederate general decided he needed refreshment?
No, but it is now on the left flank of Pickett's Charge, and that concerns us.
Jerry Taylor from Cato, what I think I've heard is we need money to basically buy out the inholdings and also influence land use around the parks. How do you come out on those issues?
Well, I agree with both Paul and Dennis about their diagnosis regarding the parks and their generally poor shape, but I'm not so sure their prescriptions are the right ones. The reason the parks are in such a mess is, first of all, there's a longstanding tension in the Park Service between tourism and preservation. The Smoky Mountains are smoky, of course, largely because of vegetation, but having grown up in western North Carolina in that area, I can also tell you it's because of all the cars that drive through there. And, of course, the National Park Service wants to encourage people to use our parks. We have millions of visitors go to Yellowstone and Yosemite and the Great Smoky Mountains and other parks. And that's all to the good, but that has a very serious environmental impact on those lands. And generally, when push comes to shove and politicians have to make decisions about whether to cater towards tourism and park visitations or to protect the parks, tourism tends to win. You can see that both with the low park fees for entry and as far as the maintenance expenditures of the Park Service. The other problem has been a host of the politicizations of the management of the parks. For example, before 1967, the Park Service would cull excessively sized herds of elk and bison because they would overgraze the flora of a park, which would do some serious ecological damage. But in 1967, that culminated a lot of outrage about how the Park Service shouldn't be going around shooting elk and bison, so they let them go. And what's happened has been an ecological disaster where they have overgrazed parklands, which has really damaged the ecosystem and changed forever, in many cases, the ecological nature of that land.
Okay,
and that's not because the Park Service, by the way, misread the situation, but they're answerable to politicians.
But before we get away from that one, because that's been a huge debate, and I don't want to spend the whole time on it, but Dennis, the challenges to the more natural management of wildlife in the park, that's certainly not where the Park Service is at this point.
The relationship here is to the northern Yellowstone elk herd and to the range conditions there. We don't agree with the view that it's an ecological disaster at all. What you get is a different kind of plant succession with larger populations of elk. Whether or not that constitutes a disaster depends on whether you're measuring it as if you were measuring cattle grazing or something. There is a National Academy of Sciences study going on right now to look at exactly that factor. With respect to the catering to tourists and the influence of politicians, obviously we are part of a political system. We are increasingly emphasizing natural resources management. We have a $100 million initiative to strengthen our natural resource management programs in the future.
One thing that raises when you think about use and access is something that I think you alluded to, Jerry, and that was low entrance fees. I know that fees to hike and so on has been a matter of tremendous controversy. Paul Pritchard from the National Park Trust, where do you come out on that? Do you think that the fees to get into parks and use the parks are too low and we should use fees as a means of cutting down use?
Peter, it seems like we're all coming at this elephant from different perspectives and we're all blind men in a way trying to find the solution to, or shall we say, trying to describe this elephant. We believe the American people have already paid for the parks and their taxes and in other ways. The American people should have the right to visit the parks, and in fact, the genius of the American park idea, which we invented and over 100 nations have replicated in some fashion around the world, is that it's built on the democratic principle that every American has a right to visit these special areas, unlike the restricted lands that kings and queens and others, royalty, would set aside for the royal families in other countries in prior times. What we are not supportive of is increasing the cost to where you restrict the parks from the American people's ability to visit them. From Denny's standpoint, part of the problem is outside the park, which we agree with. From Jerry's standpoint, part of the problem is the lack of science and research and the emphasis on tourism inside the park, and that seems to be a continuing problem. We would rather see a reservation system at least for a large percentage of the visitation so that a family can know that if they leave their home in Ohio and travel across the country to Arizona for their 1 or 2 week vacation, they're going to get in rather than be settled in on the largest moving parking lot in America in the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And I think that's the real answer, is to know you got a reservation, to know you got a ticket, to know that in that resource you're going to have a chance to experience it and not just be one of too many people who are visiting those areas.
Well, Jerry, in previous conversations, you've argued hard for using the pricing system to allocate resources more effectively. Do you see a different role for pricing access to the parks as a means of managing them better?
Well, absolutely. Look, I certainly sympathize with the desire to share America's ecological boundary as widely as possible through visitation, but at some point you have to make a decision whether the federal government is in the business of running theme parks or whether the federal government is in the business of preserving sensitive and beautiful ecosystems.
But Jerry,
the two are not necessarily compatible.
Wouldn't you solve that problem with a reservation system rather than just increasing the fee every 5 years, as we've approximately done over the past two decades?
Well, we're still so far away from the entrance fee. The former head of the National Park Service, James Ridenour, remarked a few years ago, just to have the maintenance costs of a park taken care of by the people who visit it, you'd have to increase, on average, the price of entry by about a factor of 10. Now, that gives you an idea of how much it costs to keep parks maintained versus how little revenue that they're accruing through these visitors. Now, it seems to me that if you want every single American to have an opportunity to visit these parks, what you're going to quickly do is destroy these parks, because ecosystems are not so robust that they can handle a couple million tourists a year in many cases. And I find myself in the curious position of taking the environmental argument against Paul, who would rather, I gather, open up the doors more widely than the ecosystems can necessarily handle.
Well, but I thought I heard Paul say a reservation system, which keeps some people out if they didn't get their ticket in the lottery. So the lottery, rather than the amount of dollars you have, determines it. But let's hear from the guys that are doing this. Well, Dennis, what is the Park Service's policy perspective at the moment with respect to entrance fees?
Well, entrance fees, of course, are tightly controlled by the Congress. Right now, we're in a time in which we have a demonstration fee window in 100 parks. The actual language of the statute is 100 parks, programs, or projects. And that's in place for another year or two. That has generally increased entrance fees to the $5, $10, and $20 range, depending upon, you know, the size of the park. But the point I would make is that the debate that just took place between Paul and Jerry is historically replicated in the Congress. There is a tension between the equity argument in the Congress and the user should pay argument in the Congress. And you can read debates in the Congress, as Paul says, every decade when park fees are debated, that essentially try to split the middle in that argument. And as a result, the fee system that we run is a compromise between that equity issue and getting some portion of the fees back.
Okay, I think that says it well. Let's go and look at the future for a moment. Jerry, do we need and should we be buying more parkland, recognizing that our population is probably going to double in the next, certainly in the next century or maybe the next 50 years?
I'm certainly dubious. I mean, we have to remember that the federal government owns about a third of the country as it is. I mean, we go around telling nations of the developing world and the recovering nations of socialist Europe that they need to divest their lands and privatize. And here we are, a nation which has the federal government and local and state governments owning at least a third of the country and anxiously cooking up plans to buy more. When you look at the national park system, you often think that, well, we're just dealing with a whole bunch of crown jewels like Yosemite and Yellowstone. Well, that's just not true. There are tons of parks in the system that can only be described as utter pork. For example, Steamtown National Historic Site in Scranton, Pennsylvania. It's an old rusting railroad site that Congressman McDade was able to muscle through the Congress, and he treats the park system as pork. The Kanawha National Historic Park in northern Michigan. It's a national park to celebrate the legacy of copper mining in northern Michigan. It's not a place where we're going out to visit nature and commune and to visit a crown jewel. It's basically a tourist shop for the copper industry.
Okay.
And it goes on and on.
Paul
and on.
Pritchard,
there are dozens of sites like that.
More parks? Do we need to be acquiring more land to take care of needs of the future?
Without a doubt. I would argue, and this is Paul Pritchard, that Jerry's got it wrong on this one. The issue is not divestiture. In practically a majority of those lands that Jerry just talked about that are currently owned by the federal government, you can mine, you can cut timber, you can do all sorts
of... No, those are park lands I just mentioned, Paul. Those are part of the national park system.
No, the national park system is not a third of the nation's land. The Park Service has 84 million acres. That is the smallest of the major federal land ownership programs. But let me move to the question that our host asked, and that is the issue of expansion. the issue is not whether we're providing recreation areas and just trying to keep up with the population. The issue is that we have natural areas that are not represented in our national park system, which is one of its major purposes. And secondly, there are significant themes of our history which make us unique, which make us what we are as a people. Those are not represented in our national park system. Now, those can be represented in the national park system. Sometimes they can be represented in the state park system. The real challenge for us is to give the money to the Park Service to do some long-range planning and budgeting for this sort of purpose of future needs and for operation and maintenance. We ask the Department of Defense to do preventive maintenance. We don't let the Park Service do it on anything from the infrastructure, the water systems and sewage systems, let alone we don't let them think about the future.
Dennis,
that's where the money should be coming from.
Dennis Galvin from the Park Service, as of today, what kind of plans does the Park Service have with respect to positioning itself for the future, thinking about long-range acquisition or lack of it? What is the official doctrine that you're operating under?
Okay, there are two answers to that question. One is the organization has a strategic plan which really guides the future of the Park Service. That doesn't deal necessarily with additional areas. In the case of the growth of the system, recently we, with our support, the Congress passed a law that said we will get no areas unless Congress authorizes a study. And actually, in this Congress is the first time that law has taken effect. We have submitted 11 areas that we think ought to be studied. Congress is considering those and may pass legislation soon.
And just briefly, what are they?
We are looking at things like James Madison's home, Fort Hunter Liggett, which is currently a military reservation in the Coast Range of California. We're looking at some historic sites in upstate New York associated with the Revolutionary War. It is principally cultural areas as opposed to natural areas, and that is kind of been the trend of the system is picking up sites representative of the nation's history, as Paul pointed out.
I want to thank our guests. They're Paul Pritchard from the National Park Trust, Dennis Galvin, who is the number two official in the U.S. National Park Service, and Jerry Taylor from the Cato Institute.
Thank you, Peter.
I know that all of you that are listening have a stake in our parks, and so we'd like to hear your views. Give us a call and let us know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. There are two different websites, www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. The other site is www.wamc.org. That's www.wamc.org. Last year, we told our listeners about environmental and human rights abuses occurring in Nigeria. Those abuses happened under the auspices of a military dictatorship, and some alleged multinational oil companies were also involved. But earlier this year, after an election, a civilian government was established after 20 years. The government has set up an organization to clean up oil pollution in the Niger Delta. It's to be financed jointly by the oil companies. Some critics claim the Clinton administration is trying to make the transition to democracy safe for the multinational corporations, but not for the people. So has the new government made any real changes? As the Environment Show's Mark Brody reports, change may be in the eye of the beholder.
Quite a lot of people in the community will say they don't want Shell to come or any oil company to continue. All their presence has brought them is death and dark air.
Dr. Owens Wiwa was born in Oguni in the Niger Delta of Western Africa. He knows firsthand all about having oil companies in Nigeria. His brother, Ken Sarawiwa, was executed 4 years ago by the Nigerian government, accused of inciting a riot against an oil company. 3 days after his brother was killed, Owens Wiwa fled Nigeria. He now lives in Toronto. His hometown of Oguni is home to around 20 million people and sits on one of the largest wetlands on Earth. It also sits on immense amounts of oil. Over the last 40 or so years, Shell has drilled 100 wells in Oguni, and Chevron has two. Wiwa says even though there are a number of oil companies with operations in Nigeria, Shell causes the most problems.
We want this company who first came to Nigeria and who has produced a chunk of our oil and who has also polluted a massive amount of the area to take a lead in using a good environmental practice in the place. We do not accept that they will use a different standard in Europe or in America, and they come to use a different standard in the Niger Delta in Africa. It is wrong.
Officials at Shell did not return our phone calls. The largest oil producer in Nigeria, Shell is often accused of environmental and human rights abuses. Steve Kretzman, the oil campaign coordinator for Project Underground, says the oil companies, including Shell and Chevron, are very much to blame for environmental abuses in Nigeria.
Oil companies in Nigeria operate to completely different standards, if any, than they do here in the United States or in Europe where they're based. There's virtually no enforcement of regulations to, for instance, not discharge toxic waste into the waters or onto the land, to not discharge noxious emissions from gas flaring into the air in Nigeria. And while there may actually be regulations on the books in Nigeria, there's very little enforcement of it, and the companies simply ignore those regulations as they currently stand.
Officials at Chevron declined to comment on tape, but in a written statement said, quote, "Our practice is to comply with the standards set by host governments. Where local standards are not adequate to protect human health or the environment or meet international standards of practice, we conduct our own risk assessments and incorporate standards which are adequate to protect human health and the environment and which do meet international standards of practice." Environmental abuses aren't the only problems observers see in Nigeria. Project Underground's Steve Kretzman says those problems are just the beginning.
That leads to community unrest and calls for cleanup of the area and calls for the community to be represented in that cleanup and to be duly compensated. So what the communities have started doing, particularly around Chevron facilities, is organizing to non-violently shut down Chevron facilities, drilling rigs, pumping stations, et cetera, et cetera. The most heinous thing that Chevron has been involved with recently is collaborating with the Nigerian military to violently suppress dissent.
Again, in a written statement, Chevron denies that accusation, saying, quote, "We do everything possible to resolve incidents peacefully through direct dialogue with the communities in the areas of our operations." Nigerian operations have accounted for an estimated $30 billion worth of oil and gas for the companies in the country. Chevron alone produces about 400,000 barrels a day. What that money is and is not used for is another controversy. Bronwyn Manby, a researcher with Human Rights Watch's Africa Division, says it's become clear that the oil companies are not being held to the same standards they would be in other parts of the world.
People living in the Niger Delta see very much that they have seen the downside of oil production, which is to say environmental pollution, disruption to their systems caused by the corruption, the money that comes with the oil companies, but without seeing any benefits in terms of sustained development and provision of primary health care, education and so forth that they might expect from sitting on so very much wealth.
Dr. Owens Wiwa takes the argument a step further. He says not only are the oil companies not using their money to help the community, the people of the Niger Delta are actually getting poorer because of the companies. Oil accounts for more than 90% of Nigeria's foreign exchange, and WIWA says the per capita income of Nigerians is going down as oil production goes up.
The net effects of all this pollution are, one, the people get sick, so they spend a lot of money to get well and get poor. Two, the people are very, very angry that the company does this to them and they don't get any benefits from the oil. So when the land is polluted, they cannot also farm. So economically, that has an impact on them, on their health. Since there's not enough food, that also have a negative impact on their health.
Another accusation is that companies use the oil money to influence the Nigerian government. Project Underground's Steve Kretzman says it's not a stretch to say the oil companies are calling the shots in Nigeria, allowing them to skirt environmental regulations and eliminate opposition to the company's presence. And he says the new government isn't doing anything any differently than its predecessors. Chevron denies this claim, saying it wouldn't make good business sense to do this. While the Ogoni people are caught in the middle of this dispute, Owens WIWA says the oil company should stop talking and start cleaning.
They have to first clean up the mess they have done before, pay adequate and justified compensation to those who have been negatively impacted by their abuse of what God gave all of us, and then enter into dialogue with the people.
Chevron says that dialogue is already taking place and points out that they offer scholarships to Nigerian students, help build schools, and take part in other projects to benefit the people of the Niger Delta. But that might not be good enough for Owens WIWA, who says he'd like to see the oil companies leave his town. Reporting for The Environment Show, I'm Mark Brody.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Things are looking up. Clinton is protecting the forests. The U.S. wants to use international trade rules to protect ocean fish. And the coral are spawning under the full moon in the Australian Sea. Order a copy of the show to share the bliss. It's number 513. Call 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and it's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.